Now Todd Sloan is here to share his insights on the psychological effects of oppression, which was the subject of a workshop he recently led at the annual meeting of the journal Psychoanalysis, Culture, and Society. Todd?
Welcome to another episode in our ongoing series on the psychology of activism. Organizers working for social justice often wonder why people who are sufficiently informed about issues that affect them in major ways do not immediately act and work for social change. There are, of course, many obstacles like lack of time, need for childcare, work schedules, lack of understanding of social movements, and so forth. Because of these things, many of us limit our activism to sending a check, signing a petition, or clicking like on Facebook and hoping that such acts will pile up and make a difference. There are, however, what might be called psychological obstacles to action, and these are more complicated than simple fear of retaliation or laziness or procrastination. These psychological obstacles are embedded in our character structures and defense mechanisms as a result of experiencing domination, oppression, marginalization, and exclusion. This means it should be fruitful to turn to psychoanalysis, the science of unconscious psychological processes. We could ask, for example, what can psychoanalysts tell us about the ways in which we are shaped psychologically by the various forms of oppression that we experience as we are growing up and living out in our adult lives? And how would understanding these effects of oppression inform practices such as consciousness raising, community organizing, and mobilization efforts for social and environmental justice? These questions were actually the topic of a workshop at a recent meeting of the Association for the Psychoanalysis of Culture and Society at Rutgers University in New Jersey. Most of the participants in the workshop were psychotherapists or psychoanalysts with a few academics in the human sciences. I personally found the discussion especially relevant to our efforts as organizers struggling to mobilize people to participate in progressive social movements. So I share some general conclusions here. First of all, by oppression, we had in mind constraints and subjection that people experience as members of a group due to marginalization, exclusion, discrimination, structural violence, such as poverty, and direct violence. This would include, of course, sexism, racism, homophobia, classism, as well as ableism, ageism, and other less recognized forms of oppression. How do these experiences of oppression leave their traces in the structure and functioning of the psyche? We usually tend to gloss over the complexities here with simple references to, for example, trauma or complexes, or abstract terms like alienation or marginalization. We also tend to lump together all sorts of oppression and violence and domination. These are obviously not the same. But to illustrate what the workshop discussed, we'll briefly focus on oppression related to classism, in particular the ways in which the psyche is shaped by experiences of class oppression, rendering workers less capable of recognizing exploitation at work and less likely to join with others to change working conditions, for example, by having the courage to unionize or to go on strike. This is obviously not a case of blockage due to a one-time traumatic experience, although there may be exemplary experiences of violence in individual lives, such as bullying or parental abuse, that might be organized along class lines. The effects of classism over one's life settle into clusters of memories and experiences that generate interpretations of oneself in relation to powerful or privileged others as inadequate, weak, isolated, different, shameful, humiliated, embarrassed, etc. These experiences might occur at home with authoritarian parents, or at school with teachers prone to shaming less prepared students, or on the playground, or in the neighborhood where many forms of cruelty are practiced, or in the city where differences of wealth are obvious while shopping or just walking around. They could also be related to the media, where lower socioeconomic classes are portrayed in stereotyped ways, or are simply absent from most programming. The memories and self-images linked to these experiences coalesce into a generalized psychological stance that is activated when one finds oneself in social scenarios where class position, status, economic power are in play. For example, in a personal meeting with the boss, a meeting of workers with management, a meeting of renters and landlords. In some cases, the psychological stance may lead to resistance, revolt, or sabotage, for example. But what we mostly need to understand better are the stances that get labeled as apathy, passivity, dejection, submission, withdrawal, and bystanding while others experience oppression more directly. How can we best understand these limiting psychological stances? First, we can notice that as a result of experiences of class oppression, the psychic structure may be characterized by things like constraints on imagination and agency, because there are prohibitions on expression, expansiveness, and creativity. There might be rigid identifications with dominant ideas or authority figures, and little freedom for exploration of negative feelings that might develop into a more critical and questioning attitude. There might be self-evaluations that are either idealized or denigrated as inferior, and in general, a lack of congruence between thought, feeling, and action. Second, we should also develop a concept of how the psyche might be structured if these experiences of class or other oppressions were not frequent, pervasive, or eventually powerful as they accumulate over time. One would find instead greater freedom of play between impulses, desires, sensations, and imagination and memories, greater agency and capacity for connection and relationship, congruence of thought, feeling, and action, fuller and more complex meaning-making, deep awareness of and stronger responses to acts of oppression that are occurring in the present. Now, when we turn to what practices of organizing should take into account in light of this, we need to keep in mind that the primary tasks are to enhance a person's capacity to make sense of what is going on, both emotionally and relationally, to articulate experiences, to give voice to their suffering, to feel recognized and heard by others, and to develop trust and solidarity with a group of others who are also affected or acting in alliance with one's group. It's also important to remember, finally, that organizing practices that support the overcoming of psychological effects of oppression go far beyond simple education and information. Ideally, they mobilize the senses and the body through the arts, music, poetry, spirituality, dance, and connection to the rest of nature. They should also be deeply dialogical, in order to ensure time to listen and understand what all have been experiencing and to foster visions of better futures. These are the sorts of practices that can address and overcome the psychological effects of oppression. This is Todd Sloan for the Old Mole Variety Hour.